Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. One moment to set up here. Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, October 18th. We have three cases on our calendar this morning, and they are all oral cases. Our first case is A23-0022 St. Paul Park Refining Company, LLC versus Brian Domeyer. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use it. We are live streaming, as we started doing this fall, this argument, but we are maintaining only an audio recording for posting on our website, which is our custom. With that, I think we're ready for counsel for appellant. Each of you, please state your name and the party you represent for the record when you begin your principal arguments.
If it may please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Eric Hansen. I represent the appellant in this matter, Brian Domeyer. The case before you is a relatively narrow one. It focuses on a question of this, of a doctrine about law of the case and whether or
I'm
not.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. I think we need our clock going, Marshall. Thank you.
I'm happy to take extra time.
You've got it. All right, go ahead.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It's application of the law of the case doctrine. And I'm sure the court is very familiar with the procedural history of this, but I think it bears talking briefly about what's going on. There's two parcels of property. My client had brought claims for adverse possession. In the lower courts, talked about as the west and east parcel, and that's the way it was litigated up through this court and then ultimately to the Minnesota Supreme Court. This court, on hearing the last appeal, applied the statute 54102 and applied its previous case law that talked about whether or not the person seeking adverse possession had sought to possess all or substantially all of the parcel. That was the test. Court concluded that as to the west parcel, he had. That triggered a requirement that he pay property taxes. Failure to pay property taxes when he was possessing all or substantially all was fatal to the claim.
So can I ask this? Because I do, I mean, you can get back to that, but I promise you we're familiar with it. So what you're suggesting is, with respect to the east parcel, when this goes back to the a fact finder, jury?
This right. was decided on summary judgment. Ultimately,
I'm sorry, what you would like, based on our original ruling, is the east parcel would go back to a fact finder, right?
Correct.
Which was a jury, I think, right?
Yes.
And that's what you would like to happen. With,
yes.
With application of what turns out to be the incorrect law about the payment of taxes, that it doesn't need to be on substantially all of the property, right?
Essentially, yes.
Okay. Is there any case where under law of the case, a matter was submitted to that you can think of, a fact finder applying incorrect, what's turned out to be, by virtue of appeal, the incorrect law? That's what I have trouble with. That's what I have serious trouble with.
And I think that's a fair question and one presented by this case. And I would start with the idea that ultimately, if we were to present this to the jury, the law that the jury is instructed is the one that the district court says this is the law that you have to apply to this case. So I think there
How does the McClellan case, where the law changed midstream, I mean, how do you get around the holding in that case?
The McClellan case, which I think dealt with a had to deal with payment of maintenance.
Had to do with the statute.
And the interpretation on the McClellan case was that the district court had not determined the duration of maintenance. So it was an open, unresolved issue.
Well,
and
that's
that,
what
that as a consequence, the district court, because it was not a resolved, decided issue, that this doctrine didn't apply. And the opposite, we have the opposite version of that. We have a unequivocal final determination as to whether or not there was a requirement to pay property taxes as to the east parcel. And I think that distinction is really key. And certainly I think that's the difference between this and McClellan.
I mean, a district court can't advise the jury on incorrect law. I mean, or that's what you're arguing, I guess. You're saying law of the case requires that.
I would say in this circumstance it does. And to be clear, I don't think the district court has to stand up there and say, well, this used to be the law, but it's not for purposes of this case or anything about that. Think about the context we're in. The question is whether or not there's an application of a statute that requires payment of property taxes. If this matter goes to a jury, there doesn't have to be any statement regarding property taxes at all. It's just a question of, did they meet the requirements of adverse possession, open, notorious, continuous, hostile? And the question of whether or not property taxes were paid or required to be paid never goes to the fact finder. It's just not an issue that's ever discussed because it's already been resolved.
It would have been a factor applying to correct law how does your argument differ, or how does it intersect with a forfeiture argument for not doing a notice of related appeal in that parcel?
How does it, that the
issue, law of the case intersect with that? Is it?
I think that it goes to its finality, right? If our circumstances were they had sought to, if they had applied to the Minnesota Supreme Court on the east parcel, and the Minnesota Supreme Court had declined that might be a different conversation. I would say that we still have a final outcome. The fact that they elected not to challenge this court's outcome as to the east parcel puts an exclamation point on that. As I read this doctrine, I believe it really comes down to, is there a final decision by a higher court? And here,
relative to that parcel. I mean, if both had been challenged on appeal, obviously you couldn't be here anymore, right?
Correct.
I mean,
yes,
so
absolutely.
It has to do with what was challenged to the Supreme Court, does it not?
It does.
Okay.
It does. And the Supreme Court, and I mean, the Supreme Court's got a footnote in its opinion that says, basically, we're not deciding anything with regard to the east parcel because that's not in front of us.
But don't you think the Supreme Court contemplated that it would go back down and its own legal ruling would be applied by the district court?
I don't think so. And respectfully, I mean, if the Supreme Court had wanted to grapple with that, they could have put in a single sentence that said, this applies to the east parcel. And the court noted that the east parcel wasn't in front of it and specifically said, this decision is not applying to the east parcel. And
so it's your position that even though that parcel, the question regarding that parcel was not directly before the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court had the understanding that the Court of Appeals decision would be applied on remand.
That's certainly my opinion. I mean, I think that, you know, it's clear that the court recognized that they were addressing the interpretation of the statute as it applied to the West parcel. And they were addressing this question of prior case law, of whether or not all or substantially all triggered the application of the statute. And respectfully, there were decent arguments on both sides because the case law on it was relatively unclear. The Supreme Court clarified it. It is today clear. But when it made that decision, it knew that the Court of Appeals had already concluded the opposite with regard to the East parcel, and then noted, Justice Chutich noted in that footnote, that their decision was not applying to the East parcel. So I think that it was absolutely the expectation of the Supreme Court that that would go back on the question of the East parcel, with the final decision being the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And if they had expected it to be anything else, they could have said so. I think we have the reverse. Ultimately, all of the cases that we have that deal with this doctrine stand for this idea that once something is finally adjudicated by a higher court, then the district court is bound. And essentially the argument on the other side here...
Well, you know, the cases seem to sort of consistently state that the law of the case is a rule of practice. And so, you know, suggesting that the parties in the case, the lawyers in the case, are bound by previous decisions in the case. But there does seem to be a sort of distinction between what may be done in practice versus what a court has authority to do. I mean, do you agree with that? And do you have anything, any authority that would seem to undermine my interpretation of the case law?
Well, I would say that when I read each of these cases, that if you read the cases carefully, ultimately the courts are going quite a bit out of their way to say, we're not actually undoing a decision of a higher court. So, for example, McClellan, that they talk about, well, this was never really decided. So it's not that the lower court is not following the higher court.
But it's, that's not how I read McClellan. McClellan was the legislature changed the statute on maintenance. And so the district court then entered an order or judgment, whatever,
sure.
In accordance with the change in the statute. Specifically, it said, you know, there's a well-recognized exception. The law of the case must yield to an intervening change of the law. And that's what happened.
And I
this
think
this exception
that
arises out of the general principle that a court is to apply the law in effect at the time it renders its decision.
And I think that if you continue reading that case, it talks about how that issue, the issue of the duration of the maintenance, was undecided. And that that was a justification for what the other side had argued had already been decided. The court concluded, no, it had not been decided.
Well, and isn't there an argument that... that there's an undecided question here as well, a question that has been undecided in lieu of the new intervening Supreme Court interpretation of the statute, and that's what is was before the district court on the remand.
If that's the argument, I don't think that's been articulated in the briefing thus far. And I don't think I agree with it. The question was, does the statute apply to the East parcel? And the conclusion of this court was, no, it does not. And the district court ultimately said, yes, it does, and granted summary judgment. I think that's the distinction. And there's not a ton of case law in there, but we did walk through this in our brief, and I think that if you look at each of these, Johnson, Peterson, they're all in every one of those cases where the court is not following this doctrine. The court is looking for some, respectfully, an excuse to not follow it. They're saying, oh, this isn't decided. Or when another question has to do with whether or not a district court is bound by another district court. And I would take the reverse to your question, Judge, is I have not found a single case in which something was decided on point by a higher court and later the district court has said, I'm not doing that, and that's ever been upheld. I could not find any cases. And there were some cases cited by my opponent from other jurisdictions, and it was the same sort of thing. When you read those cases carefully, they did not stand for the proposition that the lower court could disregard what the appellate court had finally concluded. And ultimately, that's what they're asking you to do.
Mm-hmm. But in the context where the Supreme Court in the interim told this intermediate court, you were wrong about the law. That's what's problematic about this, obviously. You know, as we have three levels of court here, not two.
And sure.
So it seems, if it's a matter of, I want you to tell me why we're compelled in those circumstances as opposed to being able to, as a matter of practice, to preserve the principles that underlie the doctrine itself, which should include applying accurate law, I think, at some level, that's been since determined in the intervening time. What compels us to have to do it? What's the best case that compels us?
I don't know that I can point you to a direct case, but I would say that you're faced with two contravening forces, and I believe, and I would say this is more true in our criminal than in our civil, that really one of the principal goals of our entire system is finality. Even if the answer is ultimately wrong, finality is a bedrock principle of our jurisprudence. And that's what this doctrine enforces, is finality, so that we don't keep coming back and revisiting it, because the law always changes.
Go ahead, I don't have
a question. I just, on rebuttal, if you could address the issue that Judge Smith first raised. So we have the entry of judgment by the district court, and on the east parcel, that judgment is reversed by our court. So there is no judgment anymore. And so when it, you know, so even looking at 54.02, which is what was the method by which it came to our court, you know, it says then there's no, you know, there's no final judgment until, or it can be changed, the judgment can be changed at any time until there's the entry of final judgment. So if you could just address that issue, that we've got no judgment on the east parcel now. Okay, thanks. Sorry for such a long convoluted.
No. Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And counsel for respondent.
Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Robert Bauer, B-A-U-E-R. I represent the respondent, St. Paul Park Refinery Co., LLC. The district court got this right. This case, there's not a law of the case. This court was remanded, matter was remanded back to district court to apply the law, okay? And that's what Judge Hoffman did. He said, I can't ignore what happened, and the McClellan case is
but
such.
It does seem unfair, and then we'll conference and figure out what the right course of action here is after the argument. But your client did not petition for review on the east parcel. So you were accepting that result. So why does that, I mean, that's the law of the case.
I argued the bright line rule to the Supreme Court that you had to pay the property taxes. So what the Supreme Court did is said, it threw out Grubb and all of its predecessors for 30 some odd years and said, it doesn't matter. We look at this statute and we say that 541.02, if it's not a boundary line dispute, requires the adverse claimant to pay taxes for at least 5 years. That was the issue that I argued to the Supreme Court. So I had a bright line rule. I figure if I have a bright line rule, they have to pay real estate taxes for 5 years. If it gets remanded back, they have to have a trial. Did you pay real estate taxes for 5 years on the entire tract? And that's what Judge Hoffman in district court made these findings. No, you have not paid taxes for 5 years. The respondent has paid taxes for 5 years, the plaintiff. And you cannot show that you didn't have 15 years of a boundary line dispute. You conceded it's not a boundary line case. So you have to pay real estate taxes. So the court applied the current law. And to say that it's supposed to go apply bad law when the Supreme Court says no, we're not talking about substantially all. So the issue remanded back to the district court was whether on the east parcel the appellant had claimed substantially all of the property. When it gets remanded back and the Supreme Court now says if it's not a boundary line dispute, you have to pay real estate taxes, it changes the game. The appellant here.
I completely hear what you're saying. I think many of your arguments are really persuasive. The thing I'm having a little trouble with is the procedural problem that Judge Siegel mentioned, which is that this case involving this parcel, was not before the Supreme Court.
Procedurally, you are correct. The route that I argued.
So how can you win given that problem? What is your best argument around that hurdle?
The McCallum case, that there's been a change of law. The district court, when it's remanded back, has to follow current law. It can't just ignore what's happened. We argued for the bright line rule, and the Supreme Court reverses Grubb and all of its predecessors, saying this whole thing about are you claiming substantially all or a smaller portion, you can't do that. If you're claiming, if it's not a boundary line dispute, which 95% of all adverse possession cases are, if not more, then you have to pay real estate taxes on that tract of what you're claiming. And again,
so any intervening law, whether it's a new statute passed by the legislature, whether it is a new law announced in this very same case, by the state's highest court, should be applied by the lower court.
At the time you're instructing the jury, you have to apply a current law, period. I mean, you can't ignore what's happened. If you're giving instructions to the jury, as Judge Hoffman said, what am I going to instruct the jury that I'm supposed to apply bad law? And I think one of the things in the Supreme Court, in its opinion, how do you pay taxes on just a portion of a property that you're trying to? You go to the county assessor and say, carve out this 5%, I want to pay my taxes on this. And you can't do that. That was one of my arguments was the subdivision law. It's 462.358. Says you can't do that. You have to go through the city. You have to subdivide. You have to say this is the parcel I'm claiming. You have to pay real estate taxes on it. And the Supreme Court went through that entire analogy saying you can't just claim a portion of someone's land and violate all the city laws to say I can create a subdivision of this property and go to the county assessor and say apply a separate tax parcel to it so I can pay taxes on it. That's what the Supreme Court said. That's illogical. If you want to claim adverse possession, the statute 541.02 says pay real estate taxes. And that's what Judge Hoffman looked at. The district court looked at the statute and said, it's undisputed. You have not paid taxes for 5 years, much less any years. You lose. Because the key facts that were undisputed and conceded in the district court's findings, which were concessions or were undisputed facts, is that it was not a boundary line case, hadn't had a common boundary for 15 years, you had not paid real estate taxes, so you cannot claim adverse possession of this separately assessed tract of land. Doesn't matter if you're claiming substantially all or all of it or a portion of it. If it's not a boundary line dispute, you have to pay real estate taxes for 5 consecutive years. That's the law.
Why do you think the Supreme Court included the language that the refinery didn't seek review of this decision, so it's not before us, we express no opinion?
I don't know, because we argued, our argument to the Supreme Court was, you need to adopt a bright line rule.
But I didn't see that, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I didn't see that in your response to the PFR. I can't find it right now, but I recall looking at it. And I don't recall you presenting it. In fact, you distinguished, you know, I think you had a different argument relative to the East, and I can't really remember what it was. But you, it seemed like you weren't at that point challenging the Court of Appeals interpretation of that, of the substantially all. Maybe you did at the argument ultimately.
We did at oral argument. Yep. But procedurally, what this court did is said, you're not claiming substantially all, so therefore the trigger to pay the real estate taxes didn't apply. And so when we petitioned, that was the issue before the Supreme Court, was do you have to claim, what is substantially all? And the Supreme Court went down door number two and said, that's not, we don't agree with the Court of Appeals interpretation of that statute. You have to pay real estate taxes. One of the arguments that I made at the Court of Appeals that we also challenged, and the Supreme Court did not take review of it, was that in Mr. Domeyer's pleadings, he claimed substantially all the land. That was the issue that we cross-appealed on, because are you bound by your pleadings and bound by your deposition testimony that you're claiming substantially all? He drew the map. He said, this is what I'm claiming. So my thought was that if I won on the bright line rule, that if they remand back, I'm going to win as a matter of law, because that's the law.
On both parcels.
On both parcels, I win, because it's not a boundary line dispute. We conceded that. And so they remand back to say, is it a boundary line dispute? You know, those were the fact issues in play. Is, you know, did he have 15 years? Is it a boundary line dispute? Is it not a boundary line dispute? Those were the issues to remand back to the district court. And the district court said, no, it's not a boundary line dispute. I've looked at the record. I've looked at the concessions of counsel. It's not a boundary line dispute. You don't have 15 years, so you have to pay real estate tax.
I interrupted you when I asked you, why did the Supreme Court say that? And what you're saying is, I don't know why, because it didn't need to, because my argument applied to both on its face, even if you took away, like, the argument about concession on in the pleadings, et cetera.
Right, right. Procedurally, since I've lived this case for 5+ years, is we thought the issue was he had conceded that he was claiming substantially all to both parcels in his pleadings, in the complaint, in his deposition testimony, and that the Supreme Court did not take review of that. So, yes, what I thought is if I argued for the bright line rule and the Supreme Court accepted that argument and said you have to pay real estate taxes, now we're remanded back and we've got a new playing field that says, and under McClellan, if there's been an intervening change of law, you have to apply the law that exists. And that's what the district court did. And the district court was, how can I not apply the current law? And said, I can't instruct the jury to apply erroneous law. There's been a change in the law. The new law says, I made a determination that this is not a boundary line case, that you haven't established common boundary line for 15 years, and you did not pay real estate taxes, so you lose. And that's what the district court did. It granted summary judgment based on those factors as it was remanded back to the court to decide. And that's why I believe the district court got it correct, and this court should affirm. I have nothing else. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks,
counsel. And counsel for appellant.
Judge Siegel, I want to answer your question, but I did want to make one point before I lost it. I just wanted to point you to page 20 of respondent's brief, in which they say, to be clear, Minnesota law did not change. Section 540.102 has remained unchanged for more than 30 years. That's contrary to what they just argued. To your question, Your Honor, is there a final judgment? The answer is no, there was not a final judgment as to the ownership of that parcel, but I do believe there was a final judgment as to the decision, as to the legal issue. because there was a partial summary judgment. It's done in June 4th of 2018. And I apologize, I did not bring those summary judgment documents. But that was how this issue was framed, was there was a question, and then my opponent is correct, that there's not a dispute in that property taxes were not paid. So on the factual record that we had, the legal question was there an obligation to pay property taxes? District court said yes. This court said as to the east parcel, no. I believe that finally resolved that issue, even though there's not a judgment as to the whole of the parcel, because I believe there are open issues, which goes to, I think, Judge Smith's question of what do we ultimately want? And the answer is we want to be able to prove the remaining elements of adverse possession to a jury. And it is at least theoretically possible that my client cannot show open, continuous, notorious, hostile possession for the requisite time frame required for adverse possession. Hopefully that answers your question. I apologize, I don't have those underlying pleadings. Really, this case does come down to this question of these competing values. I do disagree with the idea that, and articulated by the district court, that somehow were this to be tried, it would require a false statement of law from the court. I don't think that happens. This was an issue that was decided on summary judgment. This happens all the time. Judges, as they sit and instruct jurors are asked to resolve particular questions of fact, and they're instructed about that. There doesn't need to be any conversation about property taxes when this case is tried. It's just not necessary. So this idea that somehow this argument regarding the application of the law of the case doctrine somehow compels the district court to falsely tell the citizens a false statement of law, it is not that. This is a strange procedural case. I'll acknowledge that. But I think it ultimately does come into this question of which of these values do we hold highest. And the final point I'd like to make on that is that there is some law, some discussion in our dicta of, like, is this an ironclad rule and utterly bound? And the test, as I read it, is this an absurd result? That's kind of your ultimate backdoor out. We're not going to follow it if it compels an absurd result. And other than just generally saying, well, this is an absurd result, the question is it? And I would say absolutely not. It was effectively what the law of the land was in this state for 30 years. And the Minnesota Supreme Court concluded that this court had gone down the wrong path. That doesn't mean that it was, an absurd or unconscionable outcome.
But wouldn't it be kind of absurd to then have it back in the district court where the district court disregarded the new law of the land? I mean, that seems a little absurd, too.
I guess that really comes down to the definition of absurd. I would make it more akin to unconscionable. Like, this is deeply problematic. And I don't think that this is deeply problematic. This really comes down to what are our obligations with regard to adverse possession, and it goes to this question of how fair is it for somebody else to take somebody else's land. I don't think this outcome is an absurd result, and I think that backdoor is there, and I don't think that applying the doctrine of law, case doctrine here, results in an absurd result, and I don't see anything in what they've cited that argues to the contrary. My time has expired.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing, for your oral arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thanks. Thank you.